The canny shooters were 500 or more yards away, firing from well-concealed hard sight positions on the slopes above the highway. The snipers had the kill zone zeroed in, but because of the distances involved, they couldn't predict exactly where their targets were going to be when the bullets landed downrange.
Don't slow down!
The companions were doing their best to complicate the problem. They zigged and zagged along the rutted wag tracks on the shoulder of the ruined highway. Their advantage was in speed and in erratic movement, and being someplace else when the slugs hit. Highway 84 itself was impassable to wags, and an obstacle course for foot traffic. The jumble of fractured concrete plates and eroded asphalt was the result of earthquake, flooding, and a lack of maintenance or repair for more than a century. To run the highway proper would have been suicide. The companions couldn't move quickly enough over the tangle of rubble. It was like being the turkeys in a turkey shoot. The canny's use of snipers was a switch from the tactics and behavior Ryan and the others had come to expect. Flesh-eater packs usually killed up close and personal. This so the killers could battle over and take their respective shares of the spoils. Snipers who scored a hit from half a mile away would lose out to their brethren hiding much closer to the roadway. It was an unworkable situation unless the cannies were sharing the bounty in a more highly organized way, a way not based on brutal dog-eat-dog dominance, a real army instead of a gaggle of loosely knit bands. Ahead was a testament to the effectiveness of this new strategy. A string of waylaid wags dotted the highway shoulder. The convoy was made up of crudely armored minivans, pickups, SUVs, and RVs. The burned-out, overturned hulks were pocked with bullet impacts. Strewn along the ground were stripped, charred human skeletons, obviously cooked on the spot. No other convoy had passed this way in a while. The wrecked wags hadn't been shoved out of the ruts to clear the path for traffic. Cannies were picking apart the trade route and doing a bang-up job of it. Their canny prisoner stumbled along near the end of the file. Doc acted as a rear guard and pace-setter.
Keep moving, you abomination.
Poking and whacking the flesh-eater with his sheathed sword stick whenever he started to lag behind. From the determined, head-down way Junior Thibodeau ran, Ryan got the impression that he wasn't sure his canny kin would free him if given the chance. He was helpless, already trussed up, prime for spit roasting. Ryan had no doubt that cannies hid among the dense stands of fir trees above the highway. They were keeping well back from danger, letting the long-distance killers do the work. If one of the bullets struck home and the companions abandoned the unlucky victim, they would sweep in like cockroaches for the feast. Their bottomless appetites were balanced by a healthy fear of destruction. Darkness increased their courage and magnified their hunger pangs. The degenerate humans had largely become nocturnal hunters. That was when their chosen prey was the most vulnerable. Nightblind, sleepy, easily approached. When cannies committed to an attack, day or night, they were almost impossible to turn back. Like cougars or jaguars, once switched on, once they had a target selected, nothing less than a bullet in the brain would switch them off. The highway shooting gallery was the fastest and safest route to the Hell's Canyon Redoubt. It was the best of the bad choices available to them. Ryan could have led the others on a more direct forest route, shortcutting up and over the mountains, but the chances for a close-range ambush there were too great. The trees were too tightly packed, slopes too steep, progress too slow. And it was perfect terrain for concealing deadfall and pit traps, or anti-personnel mines. Cannies weren't fussy about picking their dinners out of the branches. Besides, Ryan had mentally mapped this road on the descent. He didn't know anything about the mountains. He had already selected the best defensive sites. There was no hope of reaching the spot where they had spent their last night on the highway and successfully turned back the cannies. They'd gotten too late a start to make it all the way there. One of the secondary sites was going to have to do. A dead-end side canyon, maybe. Maybe a cave. A place with a single opening they could defend until dawn. Daylight was already starting to fade around them, the sky edging from azure to brilliant turquoise to lavender. Ryan sensed movement behind the dark trunks and thick branches of the trees on both sides of the road, but saw no targets. They were being tracked by more and more flesh-eaters. A gathering storm shadowed them. The intermittent rifle fire was the dinner bell ringing. 50 yards ahead, an enormous hump transected the ruined roadway from shoulder to shoulder. It looked as though a gargantuan tree root had torn through the pavement. On the way down, they had made a detour around the partially heaved-up 10-foot diameter culvert. Jack was within 15 feet of the hump when heavy slugs slapped the earth, not one at a time, but in an ungodly hail, sending dust, bits of rock, and bullet fragments flying. It was a triangulated crossfire from rifles stationed on the ridgetops on either side of them. These weren't bolt guns. These were semi-auto long blasters with 30 or 40 round magazines, all working in unison to frame and seal off a predetermined kill zone. Jack ducked through the roiling dust and skidded down into the wide mouth of the culvert. It was the only hard cover close enough for them to reach. Christy, JB, and Mildred disappeared inside after him. Ryan followed, striding into the knee-deep standing water. Doc and the Kenny made it safely as well, although Junior tripped and slid headfirst into the stagnant slop. Doc grabbed him by the collar and jerked him back up, dripping. The bath might have done Junior some good had the surface not been topped with a dense mat of bright green scum and floating human bones. Gradually, the dust settled, and the ringing in their ears faded.
Everyone okay?
There were nods all around.
Not gonna be so lucky for long. If they keep us pinned down in here until sundown, we're dead. Cannies can come at us unopposed from three directions.
This pipe is maybe 100 feet long. Could be open at the other end, or ruptured someplace between here and there with a hole big enough for cannies to slip through.
Wouldn't have to be that big. Just big enough to drop in a few grins, and we'd be their next meal.
Wonder why they didn't spring this trap on us on the way down.
Trap not set, Dan.
Maybe they learned something when we slipped past them on foot the last time.
Well, it's still light. I've got to do a wreck up the pipe. If there's no holes, and if the other end is blocked off, we might be able to hold out from here. We've got ourselves a 10-foot-wide shooting lane. If we mass our fire, we can control the entrance and keep the bastards off us. If there's another way in, we're gonna have to make a break for it.
I come too.
Ryan trudged ahead, sloshing through the vile water. He advanced with his handgun drawn, in case they already had company in the culvert. The deeper they went, the darker it got. The smell of death and corruption couldn't have gotten worse. Again and again, Ryan nudged aside unseen floating objects with his knees. After 50 feet, it began to get brighter and brighter, until he could make out a wide shaft of light piercing the gloom, illuminating a charred ribcage that bobbed in the slime.
Bad luck.
They looked up at the wide rent in the steel cylinder. The split ran from the top of the pipe halfway down its side. It was easily large enough for a man to slip through. Ryan holstered his Sig Sauer and passed Jack his long blaster. Then he climbed up into the split and pulled himself out on his belly, crawling into the shadows beneath a shelf of up-tilted concrete. After scanning the tree lines above them, he retreated back down the hole. Jack returned the rifle to Ryan.
No point in going all the way to the end of the pipe. We can't stay the night here. Go back to the entrance. Draw some fire from the sniper so I can pinpoint their hides.
Without a word, the albino teen turned and splashed off into the darkness. Ryan crawled back out into the softening light. He squirmed into a comfortable prone position under the angled slab and dug in his elbows. Downrange, a wall of trees loomed in front of him. The snipers could have been hidden anywhere. He opened the rifle bolt and snicked it back an inch, making sure a round was chambered. Then he flipped up both of the scope's lens caps. With the setting sun behind him, he wasn't worried about a reflection off his front lens giving away his position. Ryan didn't sight through the scope. He needed as wide a field of view as possible to locate the targets. But he did drop the Steyr's safety and snug its butt firmly against his shoulder. While he waited for Jack to make his move, Ryan listened to his own heartbeat and consciously relaxed. Breathing deeply to slow it, he smelled the forest, clean, green. Ryan stretched out the pause between heartbeats, getting the rhythm right, finding the null, the shooting space. From far behind him, he could hear Jack jumping out of the end of the pipe. The snipers were waiting for just such a move. Multiple tightly spaced shots made the blasters easier to find against the dark curtain of trees. Ryan caught the faint orange wink of a muzzle blast as Jack continued to draw sustained fire. The hide, was a stand 60 feet up a fir tree. Ryan looked through the scope and rested its crosshairs below the erratic flash, adjusting his aim point for the distance and the 45-degree uphill shot. Then, with his cheek against the stock and his finger curled lightly around the trigger, he concentrated on his heartbeat. He steadily tightened down on the trigger, taking up the slack, bringing it to breakpoint. The Steyr punched Ryan hard in the shoulder. Tensing his muscles, he rode the recoil, swinging the scope back on target. In the field of view, fringed tree limbs shivered as a body fell heavily through them. Then they were still. The other two sniper rifles continued to rage. Jack's odds of being hit increased with every passing second. Cycling the Steyr's action, Ryan quickly located the second target up the highway to his left on a high outcrop that jutted like the bow of a vast black ship from amid the tall trees. A more difficult shot because of the solid cover. Ryan settled into position, adjusting his aim point through the scope. As his finger tightened on the trigger, as he was about to ice the crossfire and open the way for the companion's escape, he heard them coming toward him. Footfalls, hard running footfalls from the other side of the highway. Swinging the rifle barrel down, he looked over the scope and saw three figures dashing along the hump straight for him. The cannies were trying to reach and control the hole in the pipe. The third canny was undaunted by the deaths of his pals. On the run, he dumped an empty mag. As he slapped home a fresh one, he stumbled on a loose bit of rock. It took only a second for the canny to regain his balance, but by the time he snicked his blaster's action closed, Ryan had cycled another live round into the Steyr's breech and pushed up to his knees. The sniper up in the rocks was now targeting Ryan, trying to pin him down. At the far end of the pipe, Ryan could see more cannies filtering out of the trees, swarms of them. They knew where he was, too. Under concentrated fire, Ryan backed down the hole and hit the water running.
They're closing in quick. Light's fading. We've got to break out. It's now or never. Move fast, move low. Jack, you take the point.
JB rammed his fedora tight onto his head and pushed his spectacles against the bridge of his nose.
Let's do it.
Jack lunged for the covert entrance, then stopped in his tracks. From down the highway, they heard the rumble and roar of powerful wag engines. A second later came the unmistakable full-auto rolling thunder of an M60 machine gun.
It would appear we have company.
Ryan led the others out of the pipe. They peered over the top of the concrete rubble as the chatter of machine gun fire and the howl of engines got louder. This while canny return fire dwindled to nothing. The wag convoy lumbered uphill toward them. Huge, hulking forms bounced over the ruts, headlights off in the gloaming. The M60 atop the second wag swept the far side of the roadway, streaming white-hot tracers over their heads.
Keep down. You might mistake us for cannies.
With nothing to distinguish them from the enemy, rescuers could quickly turn into executioners. It turned out not to be a problem. The convoy crews had already assessed the situation and singled out the good guys from the bad. The lead vehicle was a dually tow truck with a high cab and a wedge-shaped steel snowplow attached to its front bumper. Overlapping steel plates protected the cab and windows. The tow truck pulled past the covert entrance and stopped, giving the companions cover with its broad flank. Then the driver and passenger cracked the armored doors and opened fire over the hinges at fleeing cannies with nightsight-equipped Russian SKS semi-auto long blasters. Apparently, their rescuers had deduced what was going on up the road. As a rule, cannies didn't wage all-out war on one another. The WEG crews knew what an unfolding ambush sounded like. A great primered Suburban 4x4 rolled up behind the tow truck and parked. The Suburban's chassis was jacked up for 2 feet of additional ground clearance. The windows, grille, hood, and wheel wells were covered by crudely welded sections of steel plate. Gaps left between the plates served as view and firing ports. A hole had been cut in the roof amidships, providing a gunner access to an M60 mounted on a circular track. The 7.62mm machine gun's arc of fire encompassed an unobstructed 360 degrees. A vehicle for the serious post-nuke entrepreneur. The back doors of the SUV popped open, and a burly giant of a man jumped out. He shouldered the RPG he carried and took aim at the edge of forest on the far side of the road. In the hard flash of light, Ryan saw Kenny silhouettes cartwheeling through the air, and the survivors scattering like rats, low and fast, into the forest. The tow truck crew continued to peck away at Kenny, wounded and stragglers. The crews from the other wags joined them, raining fire on the enemy caught out in the open. The convoy was the usual jumble of pre-dark makes and models, but they all had horsepower to spare. Serious muscle was required to move the weight of cargo, armor, and personnel over the wasteland.
Ha ha! Look at the bastard run!
The speaker was a mountain of a man, nearly as tall as Ryan, but 100 pounds heavier. Solid muscle, covered with a thick layer of jelly-like blubber. Most of his weathered face was hidden by a full brown beard. He wore stained denim bib fronts and a black leather vest with no shirt underneath. He didn't need one. The layers of fat and the mat of hair on his back, shoulders, arms, and chest provided plenty of insulation.
You the convoy master?
Ryan checked out the man's personal armament. The twin, well-worn blue steel 357 Magnum Desert Eagles and black ballistic nylon shoulder holsters looked like pea shooters tucked under his massive arms. The mountain reeked of joy juice, stale tobacco, and gasoline.
Holland Spruce, the name. You look mighty familiar to me, Mr.
Ryan Carter.
Not the same Carter what used to run with Trader?
The same.
I locked horns with you and your old crew once, back east. We had ourselves a little disagreement over ownership of some pre-dark knickknacks. You probably don't recognize me now. I was quite a few pounds lighter back then.
I remember you, Sprue. You weren't any lighter in those days, and as I recall, you lost the argument.
Memory is a funny thing. I recollect just the opposite.
Sprue looked over the other companions. When he got to JB, he stopped and grinned broadly.
Four Eyes was with you then, too. One mean, sawed-off little bastard.
JB shifted the weight of his pump gun on its shoulder sling.
You got that right, fat man. Only I got even less patience nowadays.
When Sprue took in Junior Thibodeau, his hairy smile twisted into a scowl.
You caught yourselves a Kenny? Looks like a sickin', too. Are you out of your rad-blasted minds? That's like taking a muty rattler into bed. For a thank you, he'll bite you in your ass first chance he gets.
He isn't gonna bite anybody.
We've got to move a ways up the road before the bastards regroup. You can pile in the 6x6 at the end of the line. All of you but that canny. My crews won't share a wag with a goddamn oozy-dripping flesh-eater. They'll blow him out of his socks soon as look at him. If you want him to keep on breathing, you better tie him to the back bumper and let him hoof it.
To lead a wag convoy through the hellscape, to deal with nature run amok at every turn, to face cold-heart robbers and muti attacks, a person had to be one hard-headed, pedal-to-the-metal son of a bitch. The kind of leader who never buckled, never bent, who kept on pushing until he or she got where he or she wanted to go. For Ryan, looking at Harlan Sprue was like seeing himself in a distorted carny show mirror. There was only one way to argue with that kind of man, and that was with a well-aimed bullet. This wasn't the time or place for that kind of an argument. The companions trotted down to the idling 6x6. JB, Jack, Christy, and Doc scrambled up onto the armor-sided cargo bed. The armorer threw Mildred a coil of rope he found inside, and she slipped it around Junior's waist, and leaving about 15 feet of slack, tied him to the wag's back bumper.
You could take this trillium off my back, Mildred. Make it easy for me to keep up.
Yeah, I could, but I won't. Making your life easier isn't way up there on my to-do list.
How far are we going?
We'll both know when we get there.
Best step lively, Kenny.
Take it easy. You're towing a prisoner on foot.
Yeah, I'll be sure and do that.
No way could the Kenny keep up.
Oh, for me.
He fell after a dozen steps and was dragged across the dirt on his belly. Lucky for Junior Thibodeau, progress was stop and go as the heavily loaded wags in front maneuvered around the route's deepest ruts. Before Mildred could hop down to help him, before the wag could roll on, Junior jumped back to his feet, grinning fiendishly.
Piece of crap.
To Ryan, Mildred still seemed normal. On top of her game, even. He wanted to make sure.
You all right?
No problems as far as I can tell. Got my fingers crossed.
So had Ryan. Behind him, a propane lantern swinging from a roof strut cast a wildly shifting light over the interior. On either side of the truck bed were battened down 55-gallon drums of gasoline and joy juice leaking fumes, and smaller drums marked drinking water. Between the barrels were stacks of car batteries, long wooden crates of ammo, and unmarked boxes of other trade goods. The enclosed space, windowless except for rifle firing ports, smelled like a bear pit. WAG crews had been camping out in back of the truck for months, perhaps years. Five pairs of eyes stared back at Ryan, with suspicion and disdain. The other three crew members were so disinterested in the newcomers that they had already curled up and gone back to sleep on their rag-piled beds among the crates. For about half an hour, the convoy continued along the shoulder of Highway 84, stop and go. Occasionally, a rifle round or two would spang into the truck's side armor, but there was no concerted attack, no enemy regrouping of any consequence. Ryan jumped from the truck bed. The convoy had parked on a flat field of hard-packed earth. The stars were out in force. Junior Thibodeau was nowhere in sight, but one end of the rope was still tied to the bumper. Cotter squatted and peered under the wag. The canny cowered on his knees behind the rear axle. He knew how much danger he was in.
You gotta protect me, brother. If you let me get chilled, your woman friend is gonna die hard.
Ryan didn't need the reminder. When he straightened, some of the other WAG crews were already closing in on the 6x6 with burning torches in hand. Their faces were hard and scarred by struggle. The companions jumped from the cargo bed and closed ranks, barring access to the canny. One of the mail drivers peeked under the WAG with his torch.
Looks like we got ourselves some entertainment tonight.
You don't want to mess with our fun, One Eye.
Let's soak the canny in gas and light him up. We can take bets on how many times he makes it around the circle.
Slice him open and feed him his own guts. Stake him outside the circle. Use him as live bait to draw in his kin. We can nail a bunch of the bastards that way.
Ryan understood the depth of their hatred. He shared every millimeter of it. The crews wanted to exercise their power over this pure evil creature. Not just for vengeance's sake. In a situation of terrible, unknowable threat, there was nothing like a little mindless brutality to take the edge off one's fear. The 6x6 driver's hand dropped to her holstered Beretta 92.
You better stand aside quick, One Eye.
Sprue cleared a path for himself by shoving the intervening bodies aside.
Back off now! Cut this drooly bullshit. That canny ain't yours to play with. Y'all got work to do. Set up the defensive perimeter and get dinner a-cookin'. Move it! Gonna be another long night.
The would-be disembowelers drifted away without comment. The fat man didn't have to touch the butts of his desert eagles. None of his crew had the guts to try to take him out. Their continued survival depended on his experience and judgment. A couple of the men set up an iron tripod in the middle of the circle. While one of them built a roaring fire under it, the other began pouring ingredients for supper into a big metal cauldron. Water, dried beans, root vegetables, wilted tops and all, and unidentifiable chunks of meat and bones. He then dumped handfuls of seasonings into the pot and stirred them in with a long spoon. Sprue noticed Ryan's interest in the fixings.
Don't worry. It ain't human.
It took both cooks to swing the fully loaded pot under the tripod over the flames. The convoy master set out a couple of shabby folding lawn chairs upwind of the fire.
Come over here, Carter. Have yourself a seat while we wait for dinner to boil. You and me need to parley.
Don't worry about the flesh eater, Ryan. We'll hold the fort here.
As Ryan walked over to Sprue, the convoy master picked up a blue plastic antifreeze jug and twisted off the cap.
Go on, sit. Swig?
He offered his guest the jug. Ryan passed the jug back without sampling it.
About 90 octane, I'd say.
How about a nice cigar, then?
No, thanks. Your folks look mighty jumpy.
Sprue's crew scurried to complete their assigned tasks. They set out extra weapons and ammo and manned the perimeter, some crawling to firing positions under the wags.
They've got good reason for that. Over the last few weeks, the situation in these parts has been going downhill fast. Cannies have been hitting us almost every night. Half my crew sleeps during the day so they can fight all night. The other half tries to get some rest at night so they can go all day. We've kept the bastards out so far, but I gotta tell you, it's starting to wear us down.
Where are they coming from?
Hard to say for sure. But they're following the same trade route we are between here and Slake City. We caught them riding around in wags, just like Norm's. Except for the goddamn sides of smoked meat packed in the trunks. These ain't no dumbass muties for sure. They fight just like us, with blasters. They learn from their mistakes. That's something a Sticky can't do. Sticky follows instinct, even if instinct says to jump off a cliff. Cannies use their brains. I want to hear the whole story about your pet flesh eater.
The whole story was something Sprue wasn't going to get. Ryan had no intention of mentioning their destination, the Hell's Canyon Redoubt. The companions kept such things to themselves. It's what gave them a leg up on the competition.
Have you ever heard of a queen of the cannies, down Louisiana way?
Sprue paused to scratch his chin. His hand disappeared up to the wrist in the tangle of coarse hair.
Can't say that I have, but it's been a couple of years since I run wags there. Louisiana norms are good folk for the most part, but they're shit poor. Not enough jack thereabouts to make me want to go back. Don't like the humidity or the gators neither.
Incoming!
Ryan and Sprue vaulted from the lawn chairs as streaks of light arced in from the darkness. Streaks of light that fell almost lazily into the convoy's midst. Crashing to earth, the Molotov cocktails bloomed orange. Their explosions sent flaming fuel flying in all directions. It sprayed over wags and a few unlucky crew members. Men and women batted at themselves as they ran and burned. Their comrades immediately caught them and knocked them down. They smothered the flames with blankets and dirt, then dragged the still-smoking victims to cover beneath the wags.
It's all flat ground out there! There's no cover for 150 yards in all directions! The throwers should be chopped down by now!
Sprue was thinking arm toss. He was thinking short range. He was thinking wrong.
Catapults! The cannies are using catapults!
As the Molotovs rained down, Mildred stuck to Junior Thibodeau like grim death, her fingers gripping the back of his trouser waistband. Christy, Jack, JB, and Doc had also taken cover under the 6x6. On either side of them, convoy crew were firing long blasters through gun ports and gaps in the wheel well armor. JB crawled up against the steel skirt and had a look for himself. He immediately turned on the nearest of the two riflemen.
What the hell are you shooting at? You can't see anything out there!
The prone crew member ignored him. He and his pal continued to rattle off frantic full-auto bursts from their AKs. They had plenty of ammo. Rows of 30-round mags were laid out beside them. From their panic, Mildred guessed they hadn't encountered a canny attack like this before. Up until now, Convoy Master Spruce's strategy for surviving the night had been to pick a campsite he knew they could defend. The response to attacks had been to hunker down and fight back until dawn. Unless the present situation changed radically, by dawn, the Circle defenders would all be dead. The only option was to pull up stakes and make a run for it before the fires took their toll. But there was a big problem with that. Running could put them in an even worse position in a hurry. The road ahead could be mined, or blocked by an impassable obstacle. In the dark, strung out without room to circle, the wags would be easy pickings for the cannies.
Flares! Put up some bastard flares!
The rest of the companions squirmed up to the 6x6's steel skirt, so they too could see downrange. Still holding onto Junior's pants, Mildred peered under the rear bumper. A few seconds later, 100,000 candle-power illuminating stars burst over the battlefield and slowly floated down on their deployed parachutes. In the ghastly white light, the companions stared out at a flat expanse, a plain of nothing. No big rocks, no trees. Not so much as a blade of needle grass decorated the pale dirt. Even the Hair Trigger crew could see there was nothing for them to shoot at. The illuminating stars hit the ground one by one, sputtered, and began to wink out. At the edge of the flare's dying light, a tiny yellow dot arced silently up into the black sky. To the right and left, two more dots shot skyward. They climbed higher and higher, until the companions lost track of them as they passed whistling overhead. Then, gasoline bombs burst in the center of the circle. JB came to the same conclusion Ryan had.
There's no sound, no flash when the fuel grenades are launched. They're using some kind of mechanical launcher. They got them dug in below ground, out of the line of fire. There's no way to hit and break the Molotovs with small arms before they're catapulted. They aren't even visible until the throwing arm swings up, and by then it's too late.
What about RPGs? Couldn't they use those?
The canny targets are only visible at the instant of launch, and then they're just pinpoints of light. Well, the trick to lob an RPG into a hole in the ground 150 yards away in the dead of night.
A cluster of Molotovs exploded directly above their heads, making the 6x6 shudder, spilling liquid fire down its metal flanks and onto the dirt around it. Intense heat and the stench of burning fuel engulfed the companions.
The cannibal bombardment appears to be coming at us from all sides.
There's no telling how many launches they've got out there.
Cannies knew this was a favorite overnight spot for convoys. Probably got their butts kicked here a bunch of times before they figured out a way to attack it. Catapults would be easy to hide in excavated positions. Cover them with mats and dirt during the day. Uncover them after dark, with the ranges already zeroed in.
JB didn't have to point out that gasoline bombs were a highly effective homemade munition, and they had the double advantage of pinning down the targets and lighting up the kill zone for long blasters. A perfect tactical choice under the circumstances. As if underscoring that conclusion, the 6x6 was again rocked by overlapping explosions and blasts of heat.
They've locked in on us.
Biggest lag, biggest target.
Even as JB spoke, a different sort of smoke began to filter under the lag. Blacker, thicker, chokingly abrasive. Jack put his palm against the undercarriage, then immediately jerked it away.
Hot!
JB touched it too, and had the same reaction.
Wag's on fire! Fuel from the Molotovs must have dripped down inside!
The 6x6 absorbed yet another flurry of blistering direct hits. Mildred envisioned the piles of rags on the cargo bed above their heads. The cargo bed loaded down with leaky 55-gallon drums of highly flammable liquids and stacked ammo crates. The smoky air under the wag suddenly became almost too hot to inhale.
Run! Run, quick, before the bastard blows!
As the companions scrambled out, JB helped Mildred drag Junior from under the wag. Then they grabbed the Kenny by the armpits and half carried him away from the raging heat at their backs. Ahead, wide puddles of fuel burned out of control. Dead folks lay face down in them, their clothes melted away, their flesh charring to ash. Smoke and flames spewed from wags all around the ring. Even as the crew resumed shooting, more Molotovs slammed on target. Mildred sensed the wheels were about to come off. And in the next second, they did. Literally. The fuel ignited in a withering fireball, which expanded to fill the interior of the circle. Before the wall of flame swept over them, JB, Mildred, and their bound captive were flattened by the shockwave and momentarily knocked unconscious. The blast saved their lives. Mildred came to on her stomach, her beaded hair still sizzling. In a flash, a third of the defensive perimeter was wiped away. And then, it began to rain. First came the heaviest debris. Truck wheels, engine blocks, armor plate, axles, wag frames, transmissions, car seats. All crashing down from the dark. Then came the lighter stuff. Pieces of broken metal, glass, plastic. And finally, mixed in with the dust and smoke, a mist of sulfuric acid from the wag load of ruptured car batteries.
Keep your head down!
Mildred shielded her own eyes with her hand. JB was wearing a hat and spectacles, so he was well protected. Others in the Fat Trader's band weren't so lucky. Blinded by the falling acid, shrieking in pain, they blundered stiff-armed into the flaming pools of gasoline and the spray of bursting bombs. Wild flurries of bullets crisscrossed the circle as Mildred, Jr., and JB reached the far side. The blaster fire wasn't incoming. It was homegrown. The cook-offs from the WAG's burning ammo stores had exactly the same effect. They chopped down the helpless crew members where they stood. The Flesh Eaters had either run through their stockpile of fuel bombs, or somewhere in the dark, cannies were popping out of holes in the ground, sprinting for the breach they had made in the perimeter. There was no time for a look back. Bullets kicked up the dirt at their feet and whined past their ears as Mildred and JB steered Junior along the inside of the ring to the Convoy Master Suburban, where the others had gathered to make a stand. Doc stepped forward, his lama raised in a one-handed dueling stance. As Mildred Jr. and JB ducked under his outstretched arm, Doc cut loose. Over her shoulder, not 10 yards away, Mildred saw two cannies go down hard, their heads hamburgered by bits of steel shrapnel and shards of broken glass. The perimeter was leaking cannies like a sieve. They poured through the breach. They jumped from between the wags and crawled out from under them, darting around the lakes of fire. Jack dealt death with his .357. He punched out careful shots, aiming center body. Christy fired her Smith & Wesson .38 from a kneeling position, two-handed. About 10 feet away, Harlan Sprue touched off both Desert Eagles at once. JB swung his M4000 up to his hip and joined the fray. Behind Mildred, Ryan dove through the back doors of the Suburban. A second later, he appeared in the hole cut in the roof. He swiveled the M60, shouldered the stock, and opened fire on the perimeter gap, trying to turn back the tide. It was a hopeless task. The cannies were in their midst. The disintegration of the convoy's defenses nearly complete.
You're done here, Sprue. You can't hold out. This is going to be over in minutes.
The bearded man furiously reloaded his pistols. His life's work was burning to the ground. He resumed firing, alternating left and right-hand shots.
Everyone into the SUV!
Mildred shoved Junior ahead of her, through the open double doors. Tying him to the bumper wasn't an option this time. She laid him out flat on his belly. Then she and JB sat on him to keep him pinned. Christy, Doc, and Jack scrambled in after them, pulling the door shut. No one complained about the presence of the canny or his necrotic aroma. Ryan abandoned the M60 and crawled forward toward the steering wheel. Before he could reach it, the driver's door opened and Harlan Sprue squeezed in. He tossed his smoking, locked-back empty hand blasters onto the front passenger seat.
I ordered what was left of my crew to bail. It's every son of a bitch for himself!
For most of the Hellscape's traders, that's what passed for a code of honor. Everything boiled down to cost versus benefits. There was nothing to be gained by dying here tonight. The convoy master switched on the SUV's powerful headlights, cut the steering wheel hard over, and spinning all four wheels, accelerated away from the spreading conflagration.
Some of your guys made it out. We've got two wags following us.
When Christy turned back to the rearview port, the two sets of headlights were gone. The plane behind them, pitch black.
Gaia, they just vanished!
Maybe they crashed down into the catapult pits.
Yeah, they're bad luck.
Sprue had no intention of going back to find out for sure, or to try to rescue any of his surviving crew. Gas pedal flattened, he skidded the SUV back down onto the highway's shoulder, then headed up valley at tremendous speed. The companions rode in silence, still tingling head to foot from the adrenaline rush. After a shuddering, jarring 2-mile sprint, Sprue slowed the wag to a stop. He shut off the headlights, opened the console, and took out a pair of bulky, Soviet-made night vision goggles.
Where are we headed?
Ryan climbed over the Suburban's console into the front passenger seat. As he did so, he picked up the pair of Desert Eagles and set them on his lap.
Better reload these.
Sprue pulled a couple of full mags from a bib front pocket and handed them over.
You didn't answer my question, Carter. Where are we headed?
Just stay on this road until I tell you to turn off. Doesn't get any simpler than that.
Ryan slapped the mags in the gun butts, released the slides, and uncocked the hammers. Then he put the hand blasters on the floor between his boots.
I want my blasters back. Feel naked without 3 pounds of steel tickling my pits.
Not gonna happen.
What's with that? I'm your prisoner now?
Christy reached around the headrest and pressed the muzzle of her .38 Smith & Wesson behind the convoy master's right ear and thumbed back the hammer.
So that's the way it's gonna be. After what we've been through together. If it wasn't for this wag of mine, you'd all be dead.
Do you think we're dimmies? We hardly know anything about you.
And what we do know isn't so rad-blasted wonderful. For example, you just left your crews hung out to dry.
If you're a good boy and do what you're told, don't worry. You'll get your blasters back.
Christy didn't explain what would happen to his blasters if he wasn't a good boy. She didn't have to. It was immaterial. Blasters were useless on the last train west.
You've got the upper hand on me. I'm outgunned, and I'm numbered. Even though you don't trust me, I've got no choice but to trust you.
You're right about that.
I've got nothing up my sleeve. No tricks. No plan to turn the tables on you. How could I? You saw my crews get wiped out. I'm on my own. Just me. I can be a righteous team player. I'm willing to work to earn your respect. I'll do what I'm told. Like it or not, from here on, we're all in this together.
Don't screw up.
Do you mind, Red? It's gonna be hard to concentrate on my driving with the cocked hand blaster shoved against my head.
Christy pulled back her pistol.
Oh, my eyes are watering and I'm about to hurl. How about getting that goddamn stinking canny out of here?
We can't tie him to the bumper. You'll drag him to death.
Then tie him to the fucking roof.
It wasn't such a bad idea. They had a long way to go. JB, Jack, and Ryan roughly hauled Junior out the SUV's rear doors.
Fuck.
They hoisted him up onto the roof, then lashed him belly down behind the roof's gun port.
Much better.
Sprue pulled on the night vision goggles, then shut off the SUV's dash lights. The WEG's interior was so dark, the companions couldn't see their hands in front of their faces. On the outskirts of Island Cityville, Sprue eased back on his hell-bent for leather pace.
Why are you slowing down?
Got a vill berm coming up fast. Old highway runs right through it. Should be seeing the lights of the gate about now.
When's the last time you were this far up the road?
Been almost 2 weeks.
We came through here the day before yesterday. Take my word for it, there aren't gonna be any lights in the gate.
Cannies?
What do you think?
Sprue pushed the night vision goggles on top of his head, then turned on the SUV's headlights and hit the high beams. He slammed on the brakes.
Shit!
Through the view slits, the headlights lit up the facing wall of a high dirt and rock berm about 40 feet in front of them. There was no one manning the gate. There was no gate to man. On either side of the rutted track leading into the ville were 15-foot-tall wooden poles, from the tops of which hung gruesome scarecrows. The stripped, blackened human skeletons were held together with remnants of their own sinew and tendon. Their arm bones were stretched out and tied to skinny crossbeams, as if they'd been crucified. Knowing Cannies, the crucifixions had come post-mortem.
Did you see any evidence the bastards were still lurking around here?
Nothing for them to eat. No one left alive. Bastards chilled them all. Men, women, and children.
Then maybe we should get out and stretch our legs for a minute.
Stopping for a stretch was something Ryan was about to suggest anyway. The companions needed to talk in private.
Park the wagon closer to the opposite gate.
Ryan took the keys out of the ignition and yanked the night goggles off Spru's head. He handed the goggles and the Desert Eagles to Christy. The companions climbed out of the back of the wag, and Mildred made sure Junior's lashings hadn't worked loose. It smelled real bad inside the berm. Junior bad times 1,000. From their previous pass through Island City, they knew what was causing it. Corpses. Lots of corpses, left half-eaten and unburied. Like wolves, Canny is sometimes killed for sport.
Sprue, stay here with Junior. Don't move away from the taillights. Christy's got the night sight. She'll run you down in a hurry. If you try anything, anything at all, this is the sad shithole where you're gonna die.
The companions moved away from the SUV, out of earshot. It was decision time.
Are we going to take Sprue with us? He claims he's been to Louisiana more recently than us. Maybe he can help us find La Golondrina. If we take him, we don't have to rely 100% on what the canny tells us. And he'd be an extra gun hand.
I know Louisiana, too. Don't need dead weight. Take the wag, leave the fat man here.
We do that, and Canny's would get him for sure.
And your point is?
It'd be kinder just to shoot him.
If Sprue finds out how to use the Mattrans system, he's going to exploit it to the max. That's guaranteed.
Just because we take him along doesn't mean we have to give anything up.
I trust you are not proposing that we commit murder after we get what we want.
No, I'm not. All we have to do is blindfold the fat man nice and tight before we take him into the Hell's Canyon Redoubt. Make sure he never even sees the entrance. We keep the blindfold on while we make the jump, hopefully closer to Louisiana than we already are. If his blindfold comes off during the jump, he'll wake up in the Mattrans chamber, but he won't know where he is. We blindfold him again before we take him out of the chamber. When he steps out into Louisiana, he'll know we pulled off something bastard unreal, but he won't have a clue how we managed it, or how to find out what it was.
We're gonna have to blindfold Junior anyway. We sure as hell don't want the cannies using this system.
Something could easily go afoul with such a plan. If we lose control of either of them in transit,
We're talking about Mildred's life here. It's a risk we've got to take.
I am not suggesting that we should not proceed exactly as you say, John Barrymore. I was merely pointing out a possibility.
Possibility noted. We're going to make triple sure everything goes right. Now let's find us some blindfolds.
In the glare of the Suburban's headlight beams, the companions rooted barehanded through the Ville's trash heap. Ryan and JB found some discarded, plasticized green sacks. The empty bags were big enough to fit over heads and shoulders, with room to spare. When the companions returned to the rear of the Suburban, Mildred climbed up on the roof. Kneeling, she pulled one of the green bags over the canny's head and cinched a cord loosely around his neck.
Oh, fuck me.
So the hood couldn't slip off.
Put your hands behind your back, Sprue.
Aw, come on now.
Christy took aim at the fat man's hairy chest with one of his own Desert Eagles. He didn't fight as Jack bound his wrists together, but his eyes were narrowed in fury.
Feel better now.
JB flapped open the other bag, then jerked it over Spruce's head from behind.
This isn't necessary. I'm on your side.
Now I feel better.
Outside the parked Suburban, Mildred and JB stood beside the hooded prisoners. They watched as their companions walked off into the night, their backs lit by the glare of the wag's high beams. The captive Canny couldn't stand still. As he shuffled his feet, he bobbed his head up and down.
Oh, feed me! Feed me! It hurts so bad, I think I'm dying! Please, feed me!
If you don't shut that piece of shit up, blindfold or not, I'm gonna find him and stomp him to death!
Better zip it right quick, Junior, or we're gonna turn him loose.
The canny continued to bob and dance in place. They were very close to the canyon's west rim. Mildred couldn't see it, but she could sense it deep in her bowels. A vast, yawning void, blacker than black. A 2-mile dead drop through the cool night air. It had taken 4 uncomfortable hours to make the 100-mile trip up by wag. Much better than 4 uncomfortable days on foot. Without the caravan's other wags to slow them, they had made good time, despite makeshift roads that had steadily deteriorated as they'd climbed closer to the summit ridge. At the end of the high beam's tunnel of light, Ryan and Christy bent and began searching the knee-high outcrops while Jack and Doc stood guard with drawn weapons. The redoubt's entry keypad was well concealed. If they hadn't already marked its general location, they never could have found it in the dark. Ryan opened the lid on the door lock's keypad.
Got it.
A wide section of bedrock ahead began to rise up, like the peak of a huge tent. The massive double vanadium steel doors of the Hell's Canyon Redoubt were framed by a basalt slab and angled roughly 20 degrees above the horizontal at their far end. Their outer surface was camouflaged by a thin veneer of natural rock. As the doors locked back, the redoubt's entry light switched on, blasting up into the sky from the rectangular hole in the ground. Mildred and JB pushed their prisoners toward the geyser of light. As they walked past the front of the wag, Mildred reached through the open driver's window and turned off the headlights. They abandoned the Suburban with the keys in it. They had no more use for it. The entrance revealed a wide ramp carved out of stone. It was grooved for added vehicle traction. Electric lights studded the high ceiling, casting a harsh glare over featureless walls. The ramp led down. Mildred made Junior walk ahead of her. To control him, she gripped the end of the rope, still tied around his waist.
Mind your feet, Sprue.
The companions descended single file. Ryan paused at the keypad mounted on the left wall and tapped in the locking sequence. The companions continued the descent in silence. Sensors concealed in the walls or floors triggered the banks of overhead lights, which kept winking on ahead of them and winking out behind. They followed the ramp's gentle bends, breathing stale air, heavy with ancient dust.
Redoubt, eh?
Keep your legs moving, fat man.
200 feet farther on, the corridor was blocked by staggered, hardened concrete barriers. No way they could have threaded the Suburban through the narrow gaps in the ramp's dragon's teeth. And the anti-tank defenses were too heavy to move aside without the aid of a bulldozer. Beyond the barriers, the ramp was bracketed by deserted guard posts. The hardened, bunker-like positions had firing ports for small arms and shoulder-fired rockets, which was an unusual feature for a redoubt. Beyond the guard posts, the ramp widened and the floor flattened out, turning into an enormous dead-end room. The doors to a huge elevator dominated one wall. Christy pressed a button, and after a moment, the doors rolled apart, revealing a cavernous elevator car that was big enough to hold 2 6x6s parked side by side, with room to spare. The companions entered the car with their blindfolded prisoners. Ryan touched the control panel, and the doors rolled shut. The descent was a precipitous, stomach-dropping deadfall.
Oh, what the fuck?
Sprue braced his back against the wall, spreading his legs to keep his balance. The smell of burning oil and arcing electrics filled the air.
Don't worry, Sprue. We're all in the same boat, just like you said.
Junior didn't react to the sudden drop, or its seemingly endless continuation. Maybe his Uzi-infected brain couldn't process the sensory overload. Or maybe his hunger had finally and totally short-circuited his fear. Their rapid descent covered the equivalent of 100 floors, roughly 1,500 feet. When the car finally jolted to a stop and the doors opened, they crossed another wide dead-end hallway and entered a mirror-image elevator. The distance between the top of the canyon and the redoubt at its bottom was too great for one shaft to span. The trip had to be made in stages. It took several elevators to reach the canyon floor, and there were two more below ground level. The strategic advantages of the setup were enormous. Nuke blast protection, fallout protection, concealment, inaccessibility. The elevator system was vital in case the MAT-TRANS unit failed. An entrance at the canyon bottom would have meant a 9-mile vertical climb in or out, with no way to move materiel or wags up from that depth. If the amount of rock that had been excavated was staggering, the deepest canyon in the world was the perfect place to spread it. Mildred couldn't hazard a guess at the cost of such a project, or how it had been hidden from taxpayers. It was clear that vast sums had been diverted without the public's knowledge or consent. When they finally entered the redoubt proper, the hallways were no longer dead ends. They spread laterally, branching out into mazes of interconnected corridors. The usual hallmarks of looting were absent. There was no trashing of the fixtures, no litter, no residue of cook fires, no graffiti. Yet the place was stripped of the expected cornucopia of pre-dark goodies: food, clothing, weapons, ammo, fuel. Scattered about were broad, low-ceilinged rooms jammed with cramped, partitioned-off workstations, each equipped with a desk and computer monitor. The cubicles had never been occupied. There were no personal items hanging from the bulletin boards, no unfinished work left lying on the desktops. As the companions walked past the redoubt's control center, Mildred glanced in. On the other side of double glass walls, tall banks of CPUs blinked in a dust and humidity-free, temperature-controlled environment. The computers were on, running minimum upkeep programs for more than a century, waiting patiently for their full potential to be fulfilled. Using the floor maps mounted to the walls under plexiglass shields, the companions retraced their steps of 2 days ago. They entered a much smaller, human-sized elevator and continued down. The lower they went, the hotter it got. The redoubt's cooling system was not operational. They were so deep that the air temperature was driven by the planet's core.
Where are we going?
To hell, Sprue. We're almost halfway there.
I don't like the sound of that. It wasn't going off when we left.
Careful now. Watch yourselves.
Dark night.
The hallway in front of them was awash, the water level almost a foot deep. But they exited the car and fanned out, sloshing through it. The corridor's fluorescent lights flickered and snapped. The Snake River ran through Hell's Canyon, but that was nearly half a mile above them, so it wasn't the source of the flooding. It was more likely the water had flowed in from underground aquifers.
The levels below us are probably submerged. Pumps down there must have failed.
Maybe we screwed something up when we arrived. Maybe the power drain...
We'd better hurry. It looks like the water level is still rising.
Slogging ahead, the companions pushed their blindfolded prisoners. They followed the strobe-lit corridor for 50 yards, then turned through a security gate that connected to the MAT-TRANS area. The low, steady hum of nuke engines was very reassuring. Hopefully, they still had power for the jump. In the MAT-TRANS anteroom, they found the water hadn't risen above the bulkhead door's foot-high jam, but it was close. One by one, they climbed inside, slopping brown water onto the raised metallic plates of the chamber floor. Then, Ryan pulled the door shut tight after them. Mildred felt the sudden increase in pressure on her eardrums, The door was both air and watertight.
Better have a seat quick-like, Sprue.
As Ryan hurried to sit beside Christy, the convoy master sagged to the floor. A faint mist began to form around the ceiling, and the wall and floor plates began to glow. There was a distinct ozone smell in the air.
What's happening?
You're gonna be fine. We're in a safe place. We're all gonna take a little nap. Been a long night. Need some rest.
The mist thickened into a dense fog that expanded in volume, swirling down from the ceiling in sinuous coils. Worried that the starving junior might wake up before the others, somehow get his hood off and try to eat someone, Mildred forced him to lay belly down and head first in a far corner of the chamber. She quickly tied her wrist to his waist so he couldn't move without dragging her along. Then, the floor fell away, and oblivion swallowed her whole. Doc pushed back from the rough-hewn table, then raised his tankard to the soot-blackened ceiling beams.
Dear friends, I'd like to propose a toast to our beloved Mildred, who, by God's grace, has safely passed this awful trial.
The other companions rose to their feet, hoisting brimming pewter mugs.
To Mildred!
Mildred basked in the double glow of the gaudy house's roaring fire and the warmth of treasured friendships. Cured. Never was there a sweeter word.
Speech!
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 A great array of food had been laid out for the victory celebration, so much that a sideboard had been added to hold the considerable overflow. Roasted meats, game and fruit pies, mounds of freshly baked loaves and rows of frosted cakes, small wooden casks of brandy, and a barrel of foaming ale. Mildred got up, her cup and her gratitude running over, her dark face flushed from the heat, the alcohol, and the amazing surfeit of delicacies. She looked from face to beaming face.
I could never have gotten through this ordeal without your help and support. As long as I live, I'll never forget what you all have done for me. You saved me from the most horrible fate imaginable. Thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, one and all.
Then they drained their tankards dry. JB grinned as he wiped his chin with the back of his hand.
But how do you really feel?
I feel wonderful. Still a little hungry, though.
Go on, then. Get to it. There's plenty of seconds for everyone.
Mildred picked up her emptied plate, but when she turned toward the sideboard, she stopped cold. She blinked several times, as if unwilling or unable to believe her own eyes. Then the ceramic dish clattered to the floor. Upon the sideboard, Christy Roth was laid out nude. She rested on the 6-foot-long platter like a white trout, sliced open from throat to groin, her body cavity cavernously gutted. Her pale limbs and fiery hair were decorated with green and yellow apples and clusters of fat purple grapes. Mildred stared in horror at her own bright reflection in the tipped-back lid of the enormous silver salver. Blood dripped from her mouth, chin, and fingers. Blood not her own. Gray pendulums of snot swayed from her nostrils. She whirled around, looking to the others for help, for an explanation. They were of no help, and the explanation they had to give was not the least bit comforting. Ryan, Doc, JB, and Jack were dead too. Half-eaten where they sat, red raw bones showing through torn layers of muscle. Infinitely worse, she could still taste them. And they tasted delicious. The cannibalism was a jump dream. The vomit was real. Harlan Sprue stood over his captors, who lay sprawled over the floor of the small chamber, still sleeping soundly. The convoy master had awakened before them. The bonds around his wrists had loosened slightly, just enough for him to wriggle free. He bent over the leggy redhead and retrieved his matching Desert Eagles from the pockets of her shaggy coat. After checking that the magazines were full, he slid them into their snug shoulder holsters. Looking around, he recalled that before he'd blacked out, Cotter had told him they were having a nap. The small room wasn't a sleeping chamber. There were no beds or cots, or even piles of rags to lay on. His first impulse upon waking and seeing his adversaries helpless had been to kill them all, but he hadn't done it. As a trader, he understood the value of crew. He still needed them. Sprue had no such compunctions about the canny. He would have shot the bastard, but he didn't want to rouse his new friends just yet. He could have quietly throttled Junior with the discarded rope, but the black woman had tied herself to him, and he couldn't do the job without moving and possibly waking her. Sprue carefully collected all of the companion's blasters. Then he unlocked and opened the chamber door and carried the armload of weapons outside. The air was still scorchingly hot. It was time to explore. The convoy master knew roughly where they were in relation to the pre-dark highway. He reckoned the wag had turned northeast, then south, then northeast again. The steepest and slowest part of the journey had been the last couple of hours. It had taken several descents to reach the ground floor of what had to be one of the largest and deepest-sided redoubts ever built. Only one location close by fit the particulars, and that was somewhere near the bottom of Hell's Canyon. By his estimate, they were 8 or 10 miles down from the summit ridge. Sprue could understand Cotter's mistrusting him, but the whole hood thing seemed excessive, unless he was sitting on a gold mine. The dream of every freebooting trader and scab-assed scrounger in Deathlands. An untouched redoubt. Sprue trudged out into the flooded hall, sending wavelets of brown water rushing ahead of him. The overhead lights flickered wildly, snapping like blaster caps. The car doors opened on the next floor. The extra-wide, extra-tall corridor in front of him was bone dry. All its lights were on, as bright as day. As he stepped out and scanned the hall, he noticed a set of towering metal doors along one wall. Sprue broke into a trot, his heart pounding with excitement. He leaned into the left-hand door, sliding it back on its rollers. As he did so, the banks of fluorescence came on automatically inside.
Oh, shit!
When he looked in, his knees nearly gave way. He saw bumper-to-bumper vehicles, semi-tractors, and what he knew to be Army Bradley fighting vehicles. Dozens upon dozens of them. All brand spanking new. And behind them, covering the entire rear wall, were shelves of spare parts stacked to the ceiling. For Sprue, it was a religious moment that only got more profound. On the other side of the vast room was the largest wag fuel reservoir he had ever seen. It consisted of immense balloon-like bladders that contained hundreds of thousands of gallons. With an effort, the convoy master tore himself away. Farther down the hall, he found the redoubt's armory. Inside were long wooden crates of assault rifles, still wrapped in cosmoline. There were hundreds of cases of centerfire ammo, towable cannons, and mortars. The huge storerooms next door were stocked with boxes of packaged rations and drinking water, enough to keep a small villa alive for 20 years. And the redoubt's nuke power was still operational. Harlan Sprue, who had just lost everything, was poised to get it back with interest. For an instant, Harlan Sprue had a dizzying glimpse of his own future. Everywhere that canny bands threatened norms, he had more willing soldiers. With his gift of pre-dark technology, he and his army would hunt the cannies down and crush them, and in the process, unite the hellscape's scattered peoples under his control. He was poised to become the most powerful baron in the history of Deathlands. To take the first step, to venture out of the redoubt on a recruiting mission, he needed a crew of fighters. He had to convince Cotter and the others to do his bidding. 3 Bradleys would be enough to start with. They could gather volunteers and return them to the redoubt for training. The next time he'd send out 6, then 12, and so on. The crews could then work their way down Highway 84, pacifying it mile by mile with hot lead. A little farther down the corridor, Sprue found the redoubt's fully equipped medical bay. Operating rooms, recovery rooms, isolation rooms. In an unlocked storeroom, he discovered quantities of drugs and cases of joy juice. He broke open a paper box and took out little vials that read, morphine. The do-it-yourself units each had their own built-in hypodermic needle. Sprue pocketed a handful of vials, then picked up a glass bottle of century-old amber whiskey. He cracked the cap and took a sniff of the contents.
Oh, Mama. That is sweet.
The convoy master tipped back the bottle and took a long, thirsty swallow, expecting mellower than mellow. What he got was not mellow at all. It was like ground glass mixed with lava, like a blazing flamethrower thrust down his gullet. Spruce spewed pink foam from his mouth, shedding his throat lining like a second skin. The liquid burned through both cheeks, his palate and tongue, and dissolved his teeth. The convoy master staggered backward, his beard and chest hair smoking as it melted away. The massive swelling of his throat completely blocked his airway. Unable to breathe, he couldn't yell for help. Help was too far away, anyway. Spruce's pulse pounded in his temples. His lungs screamed. Clutching at his throat, he dropped to his knees. As hard as he tried, he could not pull in so much as a sip of air. As blackness tunneled in on him, he knew he was about to die. In this case, Jump Dream and reality were one.
Get up!
Ryan nudged the fat convoy master with a boot tip. Harlan Sprue didn't respond.
Is he breathing? Ryan, I don't think he's breathing.
Ryan leaned down, grabbed a handful of Sprue's shoulder, and shook him hard. The obese body quivered, loose and rubbery. There was no muscle tension, and no reaction.
Fat man's chilled.
For a moment, Mildred just stood there. This third jump sleep had left her with an odd, jittery sensation in the pit of her stomach. The eerie feeling lingered, occasionally, inexplicably, coursing outward, making her hands and feet tingle. It wasn't the aftermath of an adrenaline rush. Adrenaline comedowns never lasted this long. It was more like withdrawal from a powerful stimulant drug, amphetamine, methamphetamine. Which, of course, was impossible, since she hadn't taken anything of the sort. She shook off the sense of unease.
Turn him over! Turn him over, quick!
Ryan and JB strained in unison to roll the limp mountain of flab onto his back. Mildred unknotted the rope looped around the man's neck and removed the grain sack hood. Beneath it, Spruce's face was purple. His bloodshot eyes bulged from their sockets, frozen with terror. His mouth hung open, but his tongue wasn't protruding from it.
Did he strangle on the cinch cord?
Couldn't have. Tied it loose.
Mildred knelt over the fat man, searching for a pulse at his throat under the tangle of brown beard. There was none. Red-flecked foam ringed his violet lips. She pried his jaws open wider, tipping his head so she could see inside. She plunged two fingers deep into his mouth.
Swallowed his tongue during the jump. He suffocated himself.
Adroitly, she pulled loose the fleshy obstacle, unplugging his throat. Mildred immediately began artificial respiration and two-handed chest compressions.
He's a goner.
Just like that?
Yeah, just like that.
Her face flushed with exertion. Mildred stared helplessly at the still form laid out in front of her. There was no resuscitation gear on hand, no defibrillator. Cutting open his chest for heart massage would have been both pointless and messy. Out of sheer frustration, Mildred balled her fist and delivered a tremendous blow to his sternum. The convoy master's body jerked from head to foot. His eyes blinked.
If the fat man's croaked, let me tear off a hunk.
I ain't dead yet, you evil bastard.
Ryan and JB helped the convoy master sit up.
What happened to me? I had this nasty dream. I was all alone, and I was choking.
It wasn't a dream. You were choking. She saved your hide.
Ryan pointed at Mildred. Spruce squinted up at her.
True?
It's true.
The convoy master soberly absorbed this news as he rubbed his bruised chest.
Put the hood back on him, Jack.
Why, for nuke's sake? I owe you folks my life. That's not something I'm gonna ever forget. I always repay my debts.
Jack jammed the bag back over his head and retied the noose around his neck. As soon as Mildred started moving, the odd, jangled sensation returned with a vengeance. And there was suddenly a bad taste in her mouth, too, as if she had been sucking on iron. It was probably nothing, she assured herself. The effect of all the dry heaving she'd done after her rematerialization. She put the back of her hand to her forehead, testing it. It didn't feel hot. Ryan saw the gesture.
Are you okay?
Mildred mentally kicked herself. She was being hypervigilant, inspecting her every sensation under a high-power microscope. It wasn't diagnosis, in any detached medical or scientific sense. She had no real symptoms to work from. If she kept it up, she was going to drive herself crazy. She didn't want to worry the others unnecessarily. She didn't want to distract them from the difficult task at hand.
Yeah, I'm fine.